So. Today is
the 2nd of August.
August 2nd. I'm Josh Davis. I'm with the Southern Oral History Program at UNC. I'm sitting down with Milton Coleman, and we're going to talk a little bit about Sobu, Yobu. Correct me if I'm wrong, the way you pronounced it over the phone a few days ago was the emphasis on the second syllable.
Sobu.
Sobu. Right, and I had always said Sobu.
No, Sobu.
Okay. So, what I like to typically do is maybe just start with your background. Maybe if you could say a little bit about your upbringing, your youth, and kind of your early days, where you started out.
Okay, well, I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in 1946. I grew up primarily in Hillside Terrace Public Housing Project, which is also a housing project where Howard Fuller lived there. Though we barely knew each other at the time. I went to Lincoln High School there, and I went to the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, on a $128 semester scholarship that I sort of lucked into. And my undergraduate degree is in the history and literature of Western music. When I started college, I wanted to be a high school band director, like my high school band director. And then early on, I wanted to become an ethnomusicologist and specialize in African and African-American music. So I got an undergraduate degree in music history and literature, but I also got involved in the Black student movement on the campus. And earlier, I had taught at a Freedom School. And during the Milwaukee school boycott. And I got my first newspaper job at the Milwaukee Courier, a Black weekly, after I graduated from UWM. Mm-hmm. And then that was in 1969 that I started at the Courier. And in 1970, I went south to work with Sobu, which was then based in Greensboro, North Carolina. And we had a relatively small core structure. And I believe my title was coordinator of informational services or something like that. And we started what first was the Sobu newsletter, which was patterned after the SNCC newsletter. And then later, as the group's ideology shifted more to Pan-Africanism, we renamed it the African World, mm-hmm. which was modeled after Marcus Garvey's newspaper, which had been the Negro World. Mm-hmm. And I remained there. I remained with Sobu probably until sometime in 1971. Mm-hmm. And then I broke off with a couple of the people who had worked for the African World, and we began something called the All African News Service in Greensboro, North Carolina. And it was a national printed news service aimed at Black weeklies and student newspapers. And it was a national news service. So I decided to move it to Washington. And so I came here in 1972, and the All African News Service kind of went under. And I began working for WHUR FM, the Howard University mm-hmm. radio station. And at the same time, I was the Washington correspondent for something called Community News Service out of New York, Emil Milne's operation.
Whose operation was it?
A guy named Emil Milne, E-M-I-L, last name M-I-L-N-E. he wound up being a chief of staff for Charlie Rangel, Congressman Rangel from New York, and may still be chief of staff.
Interesting. Well, wow, you just gave me a great overview of, sounds like maybe almost the first three decades of your life, just to work back just a little bit.
Okay.
Can you tell me again, when were you born?
November 29th, 1946.
Okay, and so you graduated from college in what year?
Officially in 1968 is my official graduation year.
Okay. And at the time, there was, I assume, a small African-American population in Madison, although it had probably, there had been African-Americans there for...
I was at Milwaukee, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, not Madison. Okay. Very different schools.
Yeah.
UWM, yes. Okay, so what's your question?
I guess maybe I was a little bit curious about your experiences there, because you had said you were part of the Black student movement, and I guess kind of curious about how you got involved in activism, and you mentioned the Freedom Schools, and just what was your kind of entry into political involvement as a teenager, as a young adult, before moving down to North Carolina?
Well, while I was at, well, let me try to figure out where this thing started at. I guess my first involvement came in 1964 or so. The school bus boycott, I mean the school boycott in Milwaukee, I believe was in 1964. And there was, Milwaukee public schools were considered very segregated, and so the, I believe it was the NAACP called the local NAACP called for a school boycott, and some churches volunteered to run Freedom Schools in their churches on that day of the boycott, and I wound up teaching at a Freedom School teaching Black history. Rudimentary Black history. And that sort of got me involved in activism, and I sort of stayed on the periphery of it until 1966 or 67. I think my second or third year, third summer at UWM, I got a job as a summer job as a community organizer. Working out of the Milwaukee Boys Club's facility, which was kind of between my house and my high school. And so during the summer, I would, the next couple of summers I worked in doing that same kind of thing out of a place called Northcott Neighborhood House.
What was it called again?
Northcott Neighborhood House, NORTHCOTT. It was run by a guy named Lucius Walker, who subsequently went to work for the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, IFCO, in New York. We ran summer programs for youth. I shifted to studying more African history and all, and reading a lot. In 1966, I believe it was, Stokely came to speak at UWM, and that was when he was Stokely Carmichael, later became Kwame Ture.
Did you know him, or were there SNCC people active in Milwaukee just because he used the phrase Freedom Schools, and I know that was a phrase that SNCC also used down in Mississippi, or was that just... You heard about Freedom Schools through the media, or?
I think it was primarily through the media. I'm trying to remember. I think that. I think there may have been one activist who had been with SNCC, but I'm not so sure he was. But there was not very much SNCC involvement in Milwaukee. We got most of our information via TV, so we probably saw other people who were using that term freedom schools. And also some of the people at Northcott Neighborhood House, I believe, had worked with Saul Alinsky in Chicago.
Ah, okay.
And there was that link. Because mm-hmm. this is a time when community organization was first coming about. It was kind of a new movement. And it was sort of very different from the sort of a lot of the civil rights demonstrations that were going on. And so we tried to organize communities, mm-hmm. you know, and I did that. My first summer job, you know, we went into a community and we tried to get people organized around programs that would benefit the community. And this particular neighborhood had a lot of rats running around. So I remember we went down to the city hall and complained about the rats and things like that. But you tried to empower a community. Mm-hmm. And that's what sort of got me involved. I participated in a couple of the open housing marches in Milwaukee at the time, which were being led by the NAACP Youth Council, and a white Roman Catholic priest, James Groppi, G-R-O-P-P-I.
Right.
And then I eventually let me get to college then. So on the college campus, we organized a black student group, which was called the Alliance of Black Students, and we then pushed hard for a Black Studies program on the campus.
I cut you off before, but this was before or after Carmichael came to campus?
It was after the three big events that preceded the Alliance of Black Students were a Stokely Carmichael speech, a Ron Karenga speech,
uh-huh.
and an appearance by Charles V. Hamilton, mm-hmm. who had written the book Black Power with Stokely.
Mm-hmm.
At the time we organized ABS, there were a lot of demonstrations going on different white campuses to get Black Studies programs, and we were very much inspired by the one at Northwestern University, mm-hmm. which was led by Jim Turner, and in fact when we were putting together our efforts to launch the fight for a Black Studies program, I remember we went down to Northwestern and talked to Jim Turner. And so what we decided we wanted to do was to organize the Black campus community there. And the request was for a Black Student Union. And
you mean a physical building?
No, and that's the problem we ran into, a union of Black students,
yeah.
which would also operate, which would also have impact on curriculum and stuff like that. But we chose the phrase a Black Student Union, and everybody got confused. Everybody thought we were asking for a separate building, which we were not. We had press conferences and threatened to take over buildings on campus. Finally, the faculty agreed to our request partially, but we didn't get all we wanted, and so we sort of wisely said, "Okay, forget it." They eventually did set up a Black Studies program. I think they called it the Center for African American Culture.
What year is this again?
This is 1960, late 67 and 68.
Okay.
Because my official graduation was in June of 68, but because of all of this organizing I was doing on the campus, I did not finish my senior honors thesis, and until the following year. So I didn't actually get it until 1969, but my official date of graduation is 1968.
So, to rewind just a little bit, Lincoln High, was that an all-black high school, no. Or predominantly? It was not.
No. Lincoln High School was located primarily an Italian community on the east side of Milwaukee. But the Milwaukee's black community at the time was really pretty concentrated and pretty small. And so all of the vast majority of black students went to one of two high schools, North Division High School, where Howard Fuller went, and Lincoln High School. Lincoln was about I would guess maybe a 2.5 or 3 mile walk from the housing project where I lived. And North Division was probably a little bit closer, but you could go to either one, and I chose to go to Lincoln because my parents had both gone to Lincoln, and I think most of the folks in Hillside Terrace went to Lincoln.
So your parents had also gone to this high school when it was biracial.
Yeah, but you know, the interesting thing is, and I did not learn this until much later, one of the most revered teachers among the black students at Lincoln High School was a guy named Tom Cheeks, C-H-E-E-K-S, Thomas Cheeks. And I later learned that Mr. Cheeks was the first black teacher to be in Milwaukee Public Schools.
Wow.
And he was not there when my parents were there, because there were some teachers who were there who had been there when my parents were there. My mother was born in 1924. She graduated in 1942. I started Lincoln at, 59, I started Lincoln, yeah. And so that meant 15 years later, I had a number of her teachers, right? One of her English teachers, one of her history teachers.
Yeah.
You know, the Lincoln High School population was probably majority black, a significant number of Italians, hardly any Asians, and a number of Mexican Americans, because which was a little bit, and Puerto Ricans. Because there was a Puerto Rican enclave between the black community and where Lincoln High School was.
Hmm.
And so you had to go through there to get to Lincoln High School. And all those folks went to Lincoln as well. And in Milwaukee, I think the larger Mexican American community now is on the south side. But we had a couple of Mexican Americans who went to Lincoln, including a guy on the football team. And there were very few racial tensions, the school politics was really based on the two separate communities of blacks who had gone to different grade schools, you know, so I mean I was fortunate enough to be a homecoming king. And it was because I came from the Hillside Terrace area, the projects, and my queen came from the other area. So we had a good political coalition there. You know?
The unity ticket.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the unity ticket. And we had really good basketball teams. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew of Howard Fuller's name because Howard, I believe, graduated from North Division in 1958, and in 1958, his North Division basketball team, for the first time, played for the state championship.
Did he play?
Howard's a very good basketball
player.
He's
quite tall.
Yeah, he's a good basketball player. He was a starter. it got confusing because there were two Fullers on the team, Howard and Marvin, and I think both of them were starters, but they were not related, at least to my knowledge they weren't. And then Howard got a basketball scholarship, or maybe it was an academic scholarship, to Carroll College I think it's in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And then he later went to Case Western Reserve. They played in 1958, and in the final game, they didn't win. But the next year, in 59, our basketball team played in that game against North Division and beat them. And at the time, there were 12 teams in the Milwaukee City Conference, 12 high schools. And the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association said, we think it's terrible that two teams from the same conference would wind up playing each other for the state championship. And so the next year we looked around and it was possible, it would have been possible for several teams from the Milwaukee City Conference to be among the eight that would be in the final eight in Madison, except all the schools that had two or more black starters, only one could go. The others would be eliminated. They'd have to play each other the way they set it up. My cousin's husband, who was a Lincoln athlete and now coaches, said it's still kind of set up that same way. And we thought it was, you know, if it had been the South, it would have violated the Voting Rights Act. Anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'm just, part of why I wanted to just hear about your educational background is, this experience, it sounds like you had of going to, I don't want to say integrated schools, but at least multiracial, and that was your educational trajectory before Sobu and before Yobu. Mm-hmm. And I know different people in these movements came from different kind of educational backgrounds. And so I guess before jumping to that, I was curious a little bit about your work with the Milwaukee Courier. Is that the name of the paper?
Mm-hmm, the Milwaukee Courier.
And I don't know, maybe you could just sketch a little bit about, tell us what that paper was about. I mean, I think it's especially interesting context based on where your career went after that. So what was that paper like?
Well, let me go a little bit before the Milwaukee Courier.
Sure, yeah, we skip things.
Because I've told this story before, so I'll tell it again. I took no journalism classes in college. In high school, I don't believe I ever worked on the yearbook staff. And I don't recall that we had a newspaper at Lincoln High School. We had a yearbook. Because I was a music education, or a music history major, in the School of Music, I wound up writing a lot of program notes for concerts. And that was my main writing experience, you know. And so at one point there was this young lady who worked at the Milwaukee Star, I believe it was, which was the rival newspaper to the Courier. The Courier was considered the better newspaper.
There were two black newspapers.
There were those two at the time. There were those two. The Star and the Courier. And I wanted to take this young lady out on a date on a Saturday night. And I asked her out. She said, well, you know, I'd love to go on a date with you, but they've given me these two tickets to this concert by the Ramsey Lewis Trio, mm-hmm. and asked me to write a review of it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to write a review. And so sensing my opening, I said, well, you know, I can write a review for you, you know. And so we went to the concert, and I'd written no reviews, but I understood music. And also, I should also say that when I was in college, I played a lot of music, you know. That's another story. But anyway, so I write this review. She gives it to her editor, a guy named Walter Jones, and And he says, "This is really good." And she says, "Well, I have to be honest. I didn't write that. Milton Coleman wrote that." And so I later developed a friendship with Walter Jones. I wrote some freelance articles for him. And then he started his own newspaper, which was called the Milwaukee Sun. And so there were three newspapers for a while. The Sun folded. He went to the Courier. After my undergraduate years at UWM, I started a graduate studies in urban affairs, because at this point I was no longer going to be an ethnomusicologist, and so I started to work in urban affairs, and that lasted about under 6 weeks, because I think 6 weeks was, if you dropped out before six weeks, you got all your tuition back. And I dropped out, and my roommate at the time, a guy named, Tom Norman, who later changed his name to Hakima, I think it was Hekima, last name Ana, and he subsequently joined the Republic of New Africa, and was arrested in a shootout they had with police, and he spent some time in Parchment.
In Mississippi, right?
Mississippi,
with,
yeah.
With Milton Henry and...
I think so, yeah, that seems to be right. So anyway, I had at this point written a couple of articles that had been published in what was then Negro Digest.
You had already?
Yes, yeah.
And by the age of 22 or...
I think it was around 20. Well, let me figure it out. No, yeah, it was 68, so I would have been 21 going on 22.
That was his freelance stuff.
That was freelance, yeah. One of them was a variation of the proposal that we had written for the Black Studies program, and then I wrote a couple of reviews of books. You know, I did a review of Rap Brown's book. I did a review of a little pamphlet that Stokely had written. The guy who was the editor of Negro Digest, Hoyt Fuller,
right,
took a liking to some of my writing, and so I'd done these things. And Tom, Hekima Ana said, let me get that. Okay. Let me just see if it's a telephone. They said, "Join us for worship. We're going to do such and such and such a thing."
Organized. Yeah.
Okay, back on.
Oh,
no, okay, all right. I just want to make sure you're wrong.
We're good.
Okay. And so he says, you know, you ought to go, and because once I dropped out, I got a job driving cab. I'd gotten a Danforth Foundation Graduate Fellowship, and I used to brag that I was the only former Danforth Foundation Graduate Fellow who got a job as a cab driver. So, because I could write during the day, and I drove cab on the night shift, you know, over kind of overnight, and then slept in the morning. So Tom said, you know, you ought to stop driving a cab and go work for the newspaper. And so I went to Walter Jones, and Walter Jones gave me a job at the Courier. The Courier was then the award-winning paper among Black weeklies. And
nationally, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty good. I mean, it was not. It didn't have the heft of the either the Amsterdam News, Chicago Daily Defender, Atlanta World, or any of those papers. And I remember at the time I went to the Courier, it had the largest circulation it had to date, which was 5,200. Huh. That was it. That was, you know, that was the press run. And And yet, it had a couple of good writers. It had a really good number two editor, a woman named Carol Malone, a black woman. The managing editor was a white guy named Dave Novak. It had this wonderful lady who lived to be 100 plus, named Maddabelle Woods, who wrote a your on the town gossip kind of column.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it was her nephew who was initially the photographer, a photographer there. And he took one of the most famous pictures of all, which was he's the one who took the picture of Otis Redding strapped in his seat after the airplane crashed, and they recovered the body. Mm. He took that photograph, that still photograph, and that launched him into a career in TV videography. He was subsequently replaced by a guy named Kenneth Lumpkin, Kenneth Warren Lumpkin, from Alabama, who had worked for the Southern Courier. And
The Southern Courier?
The Southern Courier.
What was that?
That was a newspaper that was in the South during the Civil Rights Movement.
Okay.
You know, I had not heard of it. You know, Lumpkin was, I don't know whether he'd been in the military or not. I think he had. But I learned so much from working at the Courier, because the Courier was, the Courier wanted to be a very relevant black community newspaper. And so we did a whole lot of things that people, that the Star didn't do, you know. And I think it was because Walter Jones was a really good editor. And he was in charge of all of the news and editorials. And we would do every week, Lumpkin and I would do a photo page, which would be the cover of the second section. And we'd have five or six Lumpkin photos, and I would write a copy block for it. And we tried to really bring the community in. I mean, we did for Mother's Day, we did a spread on all different kinds of black women that we simply called it Big Mama. Because a lot of black folks call their grandmothers or mothers or aunts or whatever, Big Mama. You know, I had a Big Mama in my family who was about that tall. You know, you know, Milwaukee's on the Great Lakes, it's on Lake Michigan. So somebody said there's a ship from Ghana that had come in. So we go down there and do a photo spread on what it's like to see these Africans. And we talked about...
So they were sailors. They were sailors. Ship from Ghana.
Yep. Because I remember we went through the day names, you know, Kwame, Kofi, all those, Kojo. And I think we listed them in there. We did a spread on the Temptations one time when they were in town. We just tried to do all those kinds of things. Plus, the Black Panther Party in Milwaukee was really raising a lot of ruckus then. Hmm. And I knew several of them. I'd grown up with them. And police brutality was a big deal at the time. I got arrested in 19, it had to be 69, sometime in 1969, because what I used to do is, I didn't have a car, but the paper was delivered on Fridays, and Friday night, I would take the newspaper van and just ride around with a police radio, just looking for police brutality. And so, of course, the police didn't like that.
Which vehicle were you using?
the courier circulation truck.
Okay.
We had one truck, and I would take it. I had to have it back on Monday or whatever, and I would park it in a driveway of a place near where I lived.
And you guys had a police radio.
I had a police radio, yeah. And so at one point, it was like early in the morning. It was like around 1 o'clock or 1:30, and the police were arresting a guy in the black community. And so and they had these, what were the precursors of SWAT teams, which were the 700 squads, which were three or four guys in an unmarked car, and they were the ones who were suspected of being the big brutalizers. And so they're arresting this guy, and I go up and take a picture, and they said, "You can't take any pictures. Show my press pass from Milwaukee Courier." And they said, "You take one more picture and you're going to be under arrest." I was young and defiant. I took another picture. Flash goes off. I go to jail overnight. And I was told that I was going to be charged with obstructing an officer, which was a felony. And so there was a good civil rights lawyer up there named Lloyd Barbee, who wound up representing B-A-R-B-E-E, Lloyd. The charge was reduced to interfering with an arrest, which was a misdemeanor. And I went before the hanging judge, Chris Seraphim, he found me not guilty, but ordered me to pay court costs, which Lord Bobby thought was ridiculous. He said, "What do you mean he pays court costs? He's innocent." Seraphim said, "Well, if you want to appeal, I can find him guilty." And so that was that. But that was the first and only time I'd been arrested for journalism. I'd been arrested a year earlier for an open housing demonstration.
It sounds like the Courier was politically relevant at this time. I mean, it's interesting to hear about this because I know in this period, especially the late 60s, a lot of major black newspapers, a lot of people thought they weren't updating. Like in Atlanta, for example, the Daily World was a Republican paper, and it was very hesitant to talk about civil rights, and there was a new black paper that came out of Atlanta, and, same thing happened in a lot of major cities. But it sounds like, from what you're saying, the Courier was staying relevant and was not afraid to talk about civil rights and not afraid to talk about this stuff.
Oh, yeah, it was the guy who owned it.
That's Walter Jones.
Walter was the editor of it. Ah. It was owned by a person younger than Walter named Gerald Jones, J-E-R-R-E-L-L, Gerald Jones, who was related to a Chicago family that owned a couple of radio stations. And
In Chicago.
And I think they owned one in Milwaukee later on, too. I think they owned either WNOV or WVON, one of them. And he was a strange kind of guy. On the one hand, he wanted to make money. But because he was younger, and because he'd gone to North Division, and because he had a whole bunch of other things, he was a good publisher in the sense that he wasn't afraid to take stands, of the paper to take stands. And and he allowed us to do things. And so, it was really trying to be relevant. It was trying to engage with this younger group of people who were into community organization, Black Pride, all these other kinds of things.
And he was young himself.
He was young himself. In fact, he had gone to school with Howard.
Fuller.
Yeah, and to North Division. And so when Howard was going to open Malcolm X Liberation University, Gerald sent me down to Durham to cover it, which was just absolutely unheard of, to send a reporter from a paper that small down there for 3 or 4 days. to cover that, because there was also, there was a Cebu conference going on that weekend, or there was some student conference.
That's, I think, 1969.
That's 1969. Malcolm X opened October 25th, 1969. And in fact, when Jim Turner, who had been at Northwestern, started teaching a class on Saturdays at UWM, I did a long interview with Jim Turner, and Gerald had that interview reprinted, and we had a bunch of copies of it. In fact, he wound up also sending me to Atlanta for a meeting of the National Association of African American Educators in Atlanta to push copies of that as a reprint. You know, and those were crazy things for someone from what was then a few years after the old Negro Press to be doing those kinds of things.
Pretty enterprising and ambitious, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
So, this is interesting. How Malcolm X Liberation University, I guess maybe this sounds like it's a good transition. You're in Milwaukee. Had you heard of this, or how did even news of MXLU get up to you guys at the paper? Did you know Fuller already by now?
I did not know of Howard's activism in North Carolina. I'm trying to figure out when I first, how would I have known about? Okay, all right. So, what happened is, I was a Danforth Foundation graduate fellow. The Danforth Foundation graduate fellows had a fall retreat at the Illinois Beach State Park Lodge in Zion, Illinois, and I met a woman named Alma Campbell, who'd gone to Tougaloo College in Mississippi and was going to Cornell. Then the students at Cornell take over Willard Straight Hall, and the pictures on the cover of Ed Whitfield and I forget Eric's last name, with the bandoliers.
This is a Black Studies protest, right? Yeah. They took over the administration building, and it was nationally all over the news.
Mm-hmm. So you know, at a weekly like the Courier, we want to cover that. And I remembered I'd met this Alma Campbell woman who was at Cornell. And I called her, and I think probably some subsequent conversation, she told me she was going to go down to Durham to because Howard Fuller was doing this thing, you know, starting this university. And she must have been the one who told me about Malcolm X, but the Malcolm X people were also at the, they were at the African American Educators Conference in Atlanta that Gerald Jones had sent me to sell reprints at. And
what
so
was it, reprints of again?
Of an interview with James Turner,
right, okay.
talking about Black Studies programs and
right.
the value of them. And I think I probably found out more about Malcolm X then. That's also the meeting where I would argue is where I met my wife, although she argues that no, it was later, it was Malcolm X's opening. And I just said, because you didn't remember me then, okay? But and I think that was when I first encountered, that's when I first came to meet Howard again and realized this is the same guy doing the basketball team in North Division.
At the MXLU opening?
No, at the meeting of the National Association of African American Educators in Atlanta. That was in August of 1969, and MXLU opened in October 25th, 1969.
Okay.
And I think also in 60, what was the year that there was the shootout at A&T?
That was 69.
69. So that would have been the spring before Malcolm X opened.
Right. And to clarify, for the first year, Malcolm X was in Durham.
Right.
Just for the purpose of the interview.
Yeah. And because the students who came to Malcolm X, there were several clusters of people. And there was one cluster from Cornell. And that included Alma Campbell, my now wife, who was then Faye Edwards, is now Faye Edwards Coleman, Ed Whitfield, Eric, I can't remember Eric's last name, and a few others. And then there was a group that came from South Carolina that Cleve Sellers had brought in. There was the group from Duke that Chuck Hopkins and Bertie Howard had worked with. And there was a group from here that a good friend of ours, Michelle Wilson, was with. And then a few others. My wife knows that better than I do because I had hardly any relationship at all with Malcolm X, mm-hmm. Liberty University.
Well, maybe you can, I don't know if you can remember much about this, but what was the opening like? What was it like to go down to, I mean, also, just to check, had you even spent much time in the South before these two events?
No, I had gone south probably around 1964 or 5 with my mother. We went to Chattanooga, and that's the first time I'd gone south. And I think we may have taken a train over to Atlanta. We took the train down there. Other than that, I cannot remember at all being in the South until I came down there. So there was a black student conference that preceded the opening of Malcolm X, if I remember correctly, and it might have been put together by a group called BSOL, Black Students United for Liberation. I don't know. I mean, the North Carolina people can tell you more about that.
Was that conference in North Carolina or in D.C.?
It was in North Carolina, to my recollection. The opening of Malcolm X was, it's really good. Now, somebody has that on video.
Ooh, wow.
Because what I remember most about it are several things. Number one, Howard gave this a really good speech. And read a letter from Stokely. A group called the Harambe Singers sang this wonderful song called The Black Magician. They were an a cappella group, and every one of them can sing their behinds off. And in fact, one of the founders of the group, I believe one of the founders, was Bernice Johnson Reagan, mm-hmm. who later founded Sweet Honey in the Rock. They were an a cappella group, and oh man, could they sing. Well, if you heard Sweet Honey in the Rock, that's what this group sounded like. They were the forerunners of that. And then in the middle of this opening, you know, Malcolm X at the time was on Pettigrew Street in Durham. And right across from the railroad track.